them that, you know, that venue. Hey, we all need to help. It's a village. Yeah.
And you're a bike person.
Yeah, I'm a bike. At 66, I'm still riding. Yeah. That's what keeps you young.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. Globally on kpfk.org.
En una noche de luna, Naila lloraba ante mí.
The program that you're about to hear is a rebroadcast and has previously aired here on KPFK.
Support for The Aware Show comes in part from Dr. Cheryl Fraser and her Reboot Your Relationship course. Further information is available at drcherylfraser.com, and that's drcherylfraser.com.
Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware.
And welcome to The Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr and very honored to have this conversation today because I want to talk about hard things, things that we need to lean into because life is tough. Life does get challenging. And the more we can lean into the challenges, the less energy they consume in our daily life. And my guest is going, why is she doing this intro like this? Yeah. Because relationships sometimes can be that challenging thing that you need to lean into that can be hard, especially if you're in a long-term relationship. Long-term relationships take work. They take communication. They take compromise. They take forgiveness. They take a lot of love and knowing because I'm in one, I know, you know, it's, I think, I don't know, 25 years? We lost count. But it doesn't really matter. It's just a daily thing that we're, you know, always growing into. And my guest, Dr. Cheryl Fraser, is a psychologist. She is a sex therapist. She's the author of a great book called Buddha's Bedroom, a classic book that really helps you to learn how to have a love that lasts for a lifetime, which I find very curious, Dr. Fraser, because we are one of two species that mate for life, right? Humans and one other animal.
Yeah, there may be one or two. There could be a penguin or something thrown in there, but let's say that it's not, we could even say it's not really natural. It's not typical.
Right.
It's odd.
It doesn't happen in the animal kingdom at all. In the species, I don't even think it happened in our cave person's daytime. You know, they just went to whoever was the survival of the fittest and so forth. And so this modern long-term relationship requires work, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And please call me Cheryl. Happy to have to say, as my mom says, you know, we know you've got a PhD. We don't need to be reminded.
Dr. Cheryl.
You know, I'm going to even hop on that word modern romantic relationship because it's really modern, right? I mean, anyone who watches these shows, the Bridgertons, the this or the that, right. It wasn't about love marriage. It wasn't about choice marriage. It was about either getting more cows from your neighbor's farmer by marrying your daughter off, or it was about alliances between your tribes way back, between your kingdoms. Less way back. And here we are, maybe in, I don't know, Lisa, the 20s, 30s, 40s of our century or the last century, the 19s. It, even then, right, during the Depression, during that time, I'm sure there was love and attraction, but it was also about, you know, handling the farm and raising the children, usually multiple children. So really, when did so-called modern love Oh, that makes me think of a Bowie song. When did it come in? And I don't know, the 50s, the 60s, something like that, the 1950s or 60s. And then here we are in a different era. I mean, we've got a powerful computer in our pocket and all the other things. And one of the things I like to put forward, and I'm not a cynic, I'm actually a romantic, but I'm a realistic romantic, is long-term love dead? Like, is the model of choosing a love mate and attempting to walk for multiple decades potentially together through our growth curves, through our life phases, through all of the things that happen, and till death do us part is a really interesting idea. So I think long-term committed love, people who are attempting monogamy, is in trouble in some ways in manners it hasn't been before the last decade or two. And we're seeing that in younger generations. We're seeing that in alternative models. And I'm a champion for long-term love, but I'm also a realist. And it's very much a journey. And I'm a wee bit, a lot, suspicious of people say, we never argue. I sometimes believe them, but never arguing. It's like, what are you not talking about? What are you avoiding? What are you frightened to show up and lean into as you were introducing us today? To lean into the discomfort, to lean into the fact that you and I see some things very differently, and that can feel threatening, that can feel scary, that can feel even like, how could I be with someone who sees the world so differently to me? How can we lean in and take a romantic relationship, as I'm going to say, a sacred journey to grow, to become more aware of our shadow, of your shadow, of the ways our ego is trying to run the show. Okay, there's an American Buddhist teacher. You're probably familiar with Joseph Goldstein. And he has a quote, which is, if you think you're enlightened, spend a week with your family.
Or your mother.
Or your mother. And I like to up the ante and say, if you think you're thoroughly enlightened, get into a long-term love affair with another human being, because that's where your stuff is going to come out. It's going to play out. It is an extraordinary path for the courageous of self-growth, of personal and interpersonal growth. And no, it's not happily ever after all by itself.
Well, I want to mention to anyone listening that this is not about long-term relationship. This show is about relationships in general. Look, I don't know if the statistics on this, but how many relationships end in divorce, first-time relationships?
It's really hard to pin that down. There's a lot of surveys and everything else, but a reasonable estimate seems to be, based on the surveys that people answer, not everybody does, between 25 to 45%. And that's just measured marriage divorce statistics. What about long-term commitment that isn't married, common law, et cetera, right?
Oh, interesting. So 25 to 45% divorce rate in first-time couples, but what about California? It's a lot higher. I hate to laugh. I don't mean to laugh, but It's very high. It's upwards of 70% in California.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And if we maybe take California out of it, although I'm a West Coaster here up in Canada on Vancouver Island, I have to check ours. We've also got some sobering information. And again, the statistics are as good as the surveys are. So I'm not going to put them forward as absolute truth, but they're very good generalizations that are reasonably accurate for us. Second marriages, the divorce rate is higher. Let's repeat that one. Second marriages, the divorce rate is higher. So when we're trading someone for the other side of the fence, the grass isn't always greener, at least not after, I would put forward, the first 18 to 24 months, when the flush of new love starts to settle out and we get into the real work of growth and growing together and hopefully co-creating something really fantastic,
Yes. And then just another statistic to kind of frame it all is, our 20s to 30-year-olds are not, what is the rate that they are not marrying right now, staying single? Is that what I would look up?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that is, but it's certainly higher. And we're hearing a lot about young people not being sexual, and not necessarily for a particular philosophical, religious, or any choice in their head, but that there's some lack of desire, there's lack of interest. We're seeing a lot of languaging and expressions of alternative ways to be in relationship. And things are really changing. not in alignment with a long-term love model with one person necessarily.
I just grokked it, and it said for the exact age 30, the 45 to 52% have never married.
Right. And that's at what age? In the 30s?
That's exactly 30 years old.
Right,
and
right.
Many people marry later, but in that age range, none. I mean, 30 to 34, the percentage hovers low to mid 50%.
Right.
So it's becoming less and less popular.
At least at an earlier age. And I'm going to vote for that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great to not necessarily get married in your late teens or 20s, or maybe even in your early 30s. Even if you're with a person long term and you choose to marry, we change so much. We all know this. We change so much in our teens. We change so much in our 20s. And I'm not against you marrying the love of your life that you went to prom with or whatever, but I wouldn't rush into the married part. I'd go through life. I'd go through a decade. Maybe even if it works for the two of you, have some of your own independence, travel separately, backpack Nepal and do the things, because we arguably change more rapidly now than we did. I don't know if that's...
Oh, think about when you were 20 and 30 years old.
Right.
I mean, so much change happened. I didn't get married till I was 37. It was way late. And I was like career focused and head down. And I'm like, oh, man.
Right. And I was a nut in my relationships in my 20s. I didn't have the skills. I had my abandonment issues, my insecurities, my beliefs in the one and all sorts of stuff that I now think is nonsense. And I had some really significant committed monogamous relationships with people I loved for 5 years, for 6 years, but they were turbulent. I didn't have skills. I was married briefly at 33. We lasted about 2 years and went boom. And I married my fellow, who you've had the pleasure to meet, when I was 49.
Oh, 49. See, that's so great. And yes, we are more experienced. We are more mature. We are more seasoned. We have careers. We have self-identity before that we don't. Now, I want to ask you, did you keep your last name?
Oh, yes, I did.
In the first marriage?
Oh, yes. Never in
question. Progressive. Oh, that's such a hot topic. Very hot topic these days.
Is it?
Oh,
there
yeah.
There you go.
There's a whole thing coming up in the news about it. But why did you keep your name marrying later in life?
Both times around, it was really simple. I'm a Fraser. It's who I am. It's just who I am. My dad, my granddad are super cool people. It wasn't about the patriarchy or carrying on the name. It's just who I am. And the idea of changing my name, just, it felt odd, unfamiliar, and I had no desire to do it.
Yeah, that it's right. I mean, I had businesses in my name. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, my name was all over my business license and everything. So I just...
Sure, same. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like a vitriol, like, no way.
Right.
My sister chose to take her husband's name. I also was reasonably sure I wasn't going to have kids. Maybe I would have hyphenated or something.
No, my daughter has my husband's last name, which is perfect. Mm. You know, that's great. And that legacy will be what it is. But it's so interesting. So much has happened in the generation divide in the last 50 years. Think of our parents that, you know, say we're in our 50s and our parents had children in their 20s. They were born in the 1930s, late 30s, 1940s.
Yeah.
They barely just got television. I mean.
right. I mean, the world is very different. And I don't know that, you know, a long-term monogamy model ever made a huge amount of sense. I happen to really like the model. And my work is about helping couples recreate, recommit, find their way back to each other when they're really struggling in a relationship, or they're simply in what I like to call marriage or relationship incorporated, which is you're kind of running your life like the business of us. The mortgage gets paid and the kids and the grandkids get dropped off at practice and picked up and the dog gets his toenails cut on time. And it's more like an incorporation. It's not bad. And the best marriage or relationship incorporated, people like each other reasonably well. They're not looking to stray or break up, but there's very little romantic connection between the two of them. Parallel lives, all about the kids, all about the family. And then, you know, where it's not an unfamiliar idea to say when the so-called empty nest happens, people are like, who are you? Who are we? We're not a we. We were a four or a three or a five, and or the careers, et cetera. So my message is that long-term love is possible. It just needs a little help. And in the incredible privilege I've had to work with couples, I have a three-month online program I take couples through. I've seen couples, and they talk about it on video. They share their stories because they want to inspire their couples. So I have permission to share this. I have one couple who found my program in their early 70s. They hadn't made love in over 30 years. There had been multiple affairs and a lot of very ugly fighting. And in their early 70s, they still didn't want to give up. They had a glimmer of a hope that things could maybe be different. And they found my program. They came to a free webinar and they're like, we're going to do this. First of all, talk about being lifelong learners. Secondly, they methodically did the work I offer and they now have a sensual date together every 6 days. I have yet to ask why it's every 6 days. I've got to find out. She said, you know, Cheryl, we used to change in the walk-in closet separately from each other into our PJs at night. We hadn't seen each other naked in over 30 years. And she said, now we walk around the house naked and slap each other on the bum and say, nice butt. You know?
Yeah. How many years? Yeah. After all they've been through and so forth.
So much. And they communicate deeper now. They said, we never knew how to communicate, ugly fighting. It sounds a bit miraculous. It's not. It's extremely hard work, dedication, and the willingness to grow and change. But there is hope to find your way back to, as I like to say, falling in love all over again with the one you're already with.
That's the message of Buddha's bedroom.
Pretty much. And in Buddhist bedroom, because I'm a fairly serious student and teacher of Buddhist philosophy, I do 4-month silent meditation retreats completely off grid. It's just a joy and it's the hardest thing ever. I wanted to bring together a way of looking at our romantic relationship and even our sensual life in terms of in what ways is the ego and in what ways is the sense of self, of Cheryl, of Lisa, of Ben, of Johannes, getting in the way of being aware of our partner's needs, our partner's different reality from us. And how can we realize that they're not wrong, they're just different? That the more we're arguing, I'm arguing to convince you to see my side of things, my reality, to make you eventually capitulate and go, okay, Cheryl, I get it, you're right, I'm wrong. It's not because we're jerks inherently. It's because we really don't know how to work with our own mind, the story our mind makes up. Our partner's late. They don't send us a text. And the story might be, oh, they're probably just delayed. That's a really healthy story. The other story might be, they don't care. They're so thoughtless. They know I worry. They could be dead in a ditch. We've gone over this before. Now, there's some ballast to that. If indeed you're a worrier, if indeed you've asked your partner, look, hon, if you're going to be more than 10, 12 minutes late, could you just shoot me a thumbs up that I know you're okay? That's a negotiation between the two of us. But the story in the head, because you didn't send me that thumbs up, can be you walk in the door and I blast you with all the barrels based on my story. Partner's story might be, oh, I'm going to be home a few minutes late because I stopped and picked him or her up their favorite food at takeout. And they don't know I'm going to surprise them and they don't need to make dinner tonight. But the amount of pain in between, because we don't check the story in our head and say, is this real? Is there a different alternative?
Yeah.
Can I let it go? Or if it's a larger issue, can we have some reasonable, even if heated, even if emotional, conversations about my perspective and yours and how to respect both of them and how to negotiate how to handle this better? Because maybe it causes one of us a lot of pain. And that's a good enough reason as dear friends to say, I'd like to mitigate that pain if I can do a small thing. I don't think it's that important, but it's important to you and I cherish you. So I'm willing to make that change.
Right. And that's how you have a conscious relationship. That's how you bring Buddha into the bedroom. That's how you have a long-term relationship. Marriage aside, it's a long-term relationship that you're talking about. And
sure.
Yeah. And so you could look at your relationship that you have and there's a million questions and it always goes back. But what are the basic three keys that you have to a great relationship if someone wants to measure their relationship against it.
Sure, sure. They can even do that. I have a free quiz where they can get a bit of a score on these three things. Now, these are three larger aspects of how I define a healthy, productive, growing, not perfect relationship. In this case, a romantic relationship. Two of them would apply to a deep friendship as well. The third won't. The first one I call intimacy, Lisa. And here I'm not using the word as a euphemism for, say, sexuality. That's a great way to use the word. We were intimate last night, but I'm meaning it differently. I'm meaning it more as psychological communication, even spiritual connection between the two of us. And that's a broad topic where I teach couples how to communicate better. Most of us are really pretty bad at that. I teach them the four behaviors in ugly arguing that lead to divorce based on some of the work by the Gottman Institute and elsewhere. I teach them how to fight fair, that you don't need to be afraid of intense emotions like guilt, anger, anxiety, fear, even feelings of hatred that can come up and go away, but that it's what we do when we're angry that matters. It's what we do when we're flooded that matters. I teach people how to stop action on an ugly argument to basically create a triage situation so we can stop further damage. And I talk a lot about repair and reconnection and apology, how to apologize like a champion, where we own the behavior. We apologize sincerely and well, and we vow to do better, and we try to think of some actions to help us do better in an arc of hopeful behavior change. I also talk there in intimacy and really want people to be great at long, winding, wandering conversations. You know, the kinds you had when you were dating, where you're curious, where you're open-minded, where you want to learn this person. And whether we've been together 5 weeks or 50 years, we do not know everything about our partner. They are vast and contain multitudes, to quote someone, Whitman. And it is ridiculous to think, I'm bored with my mate. You may be bored with your mate, but I'm going to correct that, everybody. You actually have a boring mindset. Your mate is still fascinating. If they meet an attractive, interesting person at a conference, at work tomorrow, on the ski hill, or picking up your son or grandson from hockey practice, Canadian reference there, they could easily end up in a conversation. This is your boring mate with someone new who will find them absolutely fascinating. It's because we've heard it before and we don't bring a mind of novelty to the conversation. We don't bring a mind of curiosity to the conversation that we're bored with our mate and our relationship far too often. So another part of this, only first of the three of intimacy, is deep conversations. What are your hopes and dreams these days? You know, I like to ask people about each partner, do you these days have a sense of one thing that's really bothering your partner? Could be about their health, their work, a colleague, a sister, a brother, you. Do you know something they're really looking forward to or they're excited about? It can be really small. They might be excited that you're going for Thai food on Friday, but you kind of, do you know? And if not, ask them. Will they be able to answer that question about you? Would they say, yeah, are really worried about this possible merger that might affect the company and it's really on their mind? Or they're worried about the wart on their toe because they want to go jogging and it might get in the way. Big or small, how tuned in are you to each other? Mm-hmm. That's the first big, vast, deep, broad aspect of a great relationship.
Nice. You know, I know that there's a lot to be said about this, and a lot of people, we're not just necessarily talking about marriage. We're talking about long-term relationships and increasing the level of communication. And this is healthy with any type of relationship. And there is a fun drive going on at our network right now. And we are always, you know, raising money because it is public radio and we appreciate your donations and we really appreciate that's how we keep going. You are our sponsors. And there is a wonderful gift, a bonus. If you can donate $50 to KPFK right now, $50 pledge to KPFK, Dr. Cheryl Fraser has an amazing 5-part video series with worksheets. And it's called Reboot Your Relationship. And it is a great course that gives you videos, short videos for all of us with short attention spans, and workbooks, you know, ways that you can really workshop. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? Cheryl?
Sure. It's a deeper dive into these three, what I call the three keys to passion or the three keys to great relationships. So you'll get a video on each one, and there's a worksheet that you can do, your partner can do, and it's going to start conversations maybe you're not having. Because we can't make any changes without looking at the way things are. If we're having a medical issue, a fitness issue, you know, we kind of have to step on the scale or measure ourselves or get the blood test done to say, okay, this is the baseline. This is what's going well. This is what needs some tweaking, improvement, treatment, or change. So it's a way to really have those conversations. And some of them won't be super comfortable because we may say, you know, we're really not paying a lot of attention to these deeper, longer conversations that help me reacquaint myself with the wonder that is you. How can we improve that? Can we start taking the dog for a hike, one of my favorites with my sweetheart, in the woods, and we talk for an hour or two in this kind of winding way, both in terms of our bodies winding through the gorgeous countryside here, and in terms of we don't have an agenda for the conversation. We just talk and we listen and we're away from distraction, device, and the dust in the corner that's calling for a vacuum.
Yes.
And it's just us. And then there's an eagle flying overhead. And then we, you know, in the spring, I took the dog this morning and the tree frogs are croaking. And it's just a way to be alive together. I know you love nature. And I was listening to one of your earlier episodes from a while ago, I think with Michael Tobin. And you were talking about one of your best pieces of advice for people in relationship is to do something exciting and interesting, ideally outside with the one you love.
I just said this morning to my husband because so we do this Wednesday morning ride every Wednesday, and we start the ride together for 30 minutes and then meet a big pack of people. And then I go my way and he goes his way, which is great because they're scary for me. And yeah. And so that is such a cool thing to do. And I said that to him this morning. I'm like, because we're going through, like, you know, there's barriers and there's traffic and there's things like that that we have to navigate through together. And then he helps me with certain things. And then, you know, we ride side by side in certain places and areas. And it's such a cool thing that we navigate together every Wednesday. And then we ride on Saturdays together. And we have that thing together. We have that and everything else. I mean, we happen to work together. We live together. We do a lot together. And I just love that we have something that gives us freedom, nature, mm-hmm. adrenaline, mm-hmm. all of that comes in. That's our space. We love riding together.
Yeah. It's fabulous. And there was some great research. It's old research. It's from, I think, the late 80s. It was done in Vancouver, Canada. But there was this study done by Dr. Don Dutton, a psychologist. And I'll keep it really brief. It was at the time one of the higher suspension bridges in the world. I'm sure it's been massively surpassed since. But it was in the Capilano Canyon outside Vancouver. And this researcher wanted to figure out whether being in a state of sort of excited arousal, i.e. kind of elevated because you're walking across an intense suspension bridge quite high,
right,
whether it would affect how attracted someone felt to someone. So to cut to the chase, what they found was they had a reasonably attractive female research assistant, i.e., you know, a fake. And she was at one end of the bridge. And she would ask these benign questions of various men as they came off the bridge, like, oh, we're doing a study on the water quality of the river and want to ask you three questions. And then at the end, they would say, because it was before cell phones, you know, if you have any follow-up questions on the water quality study, here's the lab phone number. You can call me there. So that was the hook, right? So half of the men were interviewed after walking across this you know, exhilarating bridge where their adrenaline and cortisol was probably up. The other half were interviewed when they got out of their car in the parking lot. And it was pretty significant findings that the persons who were in a novel, exciting outdoor environment and kind of excited were much more likely to call the female researcher.
Yes.
So presumably more attraction, more interest. And doing something novel, exciting, or different, it doesn't have to be a massive mountain bike ride or going across a scary bridge. It can be as simple as going to a new restaurant or going to a dance class or going on a hike somewhere you've never been, has been shown to make your partner feel more attractive to you. So get off your bums, may I say, everybody, and go do something different with your partner. I challenge all the couples I work with to go on what I call adventure dates. Again, they don't have to be adventurous the way you and I, fairly adventurous ladies, would define them. But something different and out of routine. And it can bond you in a way that helps with this side of the three sides. And it blends into the second one. You want to hear about the second one?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm reminded of our dance experience that we, Cheryl and I are part of a community organization, and we had to be each other's dance partners, that we were led by these amazing professional dancers from Dancing with the Stars, and everybody else, we were like the five runner-ups in this dance competition. Everybody else was a male, female. And it was like, all right, we're going to do this. It was really fun.
I think you had to lead me. It was like a salsa style. We needed a leader and a follower, eye gaze and intimacy. Right. So we did something novel and exciting, and it bonded us.
Yes, it did.
Probably really even more than a deep, meaningful conversation might have, although that would bond us as well. So this is a beautiful segue into the second side of great relationship, the second side of what I call the passion triangle. I call it thrill. And we're touching on it a lot already, doing novel things with each other. And I know people can roll their eyes when I say, go on dates with your partner already. People are like, oh, every time I'm in a dentist's office and read an article, how old I am, like there's magazines anymore. But anyway, and it says, date your partner. I know. And I say, uh-huh, but are you doing it? And then they look chagrined, because it's the aspect, what I call thrill, is a way to capture the feelings, Lisa, that came so naturally when we were dating. We were locked and loaded on this person. We were excited to see them. We made effort, didn't we? We planned. We thought of cool things to do. We looked for things to do.
We looked our best.
Oh, yeah. Did we ever? We wore the nice underwear. Even the guys, even the heterosexual guys, the gay guys had it covered. But the heterosexual guys even probably put on decent underwear and a nice shirt.
Right.
No. There was effort. There was intentionality. There was, I love this word, wooing. Was happening, right? There was a sense of pursuit on both sides. And if you were as busy as you and I and almost everybody listening is in our lives these days, you still created time. You said, I can't do Thursday. Can you do Friday? I can't do Friday. Saturday? Yeah, I've got between 2 and 5. Nail it in. We're going on a date, an adventure, a something.
Yeah.
And that really fades in the majority, not all, of long-term romantic relationships, the deadly sin, in my opinion, of complacency, of taking each other for granted. You know, people will say, I used to feel like the most important thing, creature, anything in his or her or their world. Now I feel like I'm a piece of the furniture.
Right. Well, I mean, can we talk a little bit about that with the empty nesters, people that I have been in a relationship and it's been a quad. It's been, you know, a family unit. And then the kids, they go to college, they have to, you know, adult, and they become adults. They are adults. And the whole idea is to raise healthy adults. And then all of a sudden you're staring at each other going, what just happened?
Right, right. A purpose is partly or mostly gone. A sense of, frankly, and people don't love to hear this, but most of them say, that's somewhat familiar. You had very good reasons to live parallel lives. You were very invested in growing the family, doing the things, running around, all the incredible breadth and depth of things it takes to raise a child or more than a child. And what I hear over and over again, and a lot of the couples in my program are in their 50s and 60s. They're kind of like, who are we now?
I wonder why.
How do we find each other again? You know, we're roommates, not lovers. We're bored. We bicker or we don't bicker or we fight a lot and we can't get on the same page. We're feeling unfulfilled. We're wondering if this is it. Do these phrases sound familiar to our listeners? They're such common phrases. I love them, dot, 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 but I'm not in love with them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding. Are you cultivating thrill? The word thrill, I don't want to mislead people. It doesn't mean it has to be fireworks and drama. I mean, are you cultivating the sorts of things you did in the earlier months and year or two? Are you being intentional? Are you making love intentional? One of the simplest things I teach is make your love life a hobby. So I'm teaching it to everybody listening right now. What is a hobby? I'm going to put you on the spot. You're a smart lady. How would you define a hobby? Like what makes something a hobby, Lisa? What would you say?
Oh, something you enjoy doing, that you do on your free time, that is something you think about on the weekend. I don't know. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. We don't get paid for it. It's important to us. You already said the most key things. We want to do it. We make time for it. We might do it on a weekend. So we make it a priority. Yeah. Right? My brother-in-law was an avid golfer, and when their family was young, two young girls, he still, for the most part, when it didn't negatively affect the family, he carved out his 4 or 5 hours on a Sunday to go golfing, and it was tremendous for him, and my sister supported it, and it worked really well. Where are we carving out that 4 or 5 hours for each other?
Right. Anymore. Right. So it's such
a simple concept, but I see people light up like light bulbs when I teach it. They say, oh, yeah, it's something that I want to do, that I make time for. I make a priority, just like when you were dating. And you put some time and energy into it, and I'll raise you one. If we have a hobby, bike riding, pottery, painting, learning how to cook new things, we often want to train to get better at it. We want to seek out a coach or watch a great YouTube video or learn or read a book on it. We'd like to keep improving, right? Oh. We don't just say, oh, yeah, I make the same pot every time and I paint it with the same glaze. That's too much what so many long-term relationships have fallen into, the same all the time.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. And it's so, I'm curious, I was wondering why most of your clients are in their 60s and 70s, but you said it's a long-term relationship thing. But this also applies to people before they get into...
Absolutely. Let me clarify. 50s, 60s, and 70s. 50s and 60s, most of the people who seek out my program. And I wonder if it's partly because the people in their 30s and 40s are frankly too damn busy. Like the idea of working on something else, of putting energy into something else, we're like so drowning with career and mortgage and kids and all the things.
The statistic is that 50% of the 30-year-olds are getting married. That's why.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not in long-term relationships.
I love it when I get couples in their 30s and 40s and in their first 5, 10, or 15 years, because then they can lay down skills that none of us are taught. If I ran the world, we'd be taught the fundamentals of conflict resolution in the 5th grade, the 8th grade, the 10th grade, and we'd be taught very well about sensuality and sexuality and consent and love and respect and all that stuff in our in our late high school years. And we'd come out with some idea of how to be in relationship and what's tolerable and what's not. And conflict resolution, first and foremost, in the workplace, in the political realm, with your neighbor who cut down your favorite tree and didn't ask you. How the heck do we handle our emotions and our conflict in general? Not very well.
I know. And that is very true. I mean, there's so much that has changed in the face of relationship lately, and it's been for the better. But your topic is very important because, look, we hire financial advisors or we hire realtors or we hire people that are experts in their fields for every other industry except our love lives. And that's there's a reason why it works to have somebody who's a coach or that can take you through this to look ahead and also to look how do you solve this and
how do you heal the past? How do you anticipate some reasonably predictable roadblocks for you, each of you in the future? And how do you deal with the now? And, you know, one of the things that saddens me, but I hear it over and over, and a lot of my clients say they've been to 2 or 3 or 4 couples therapists, and it wasn't helpful.
Yeah.
And then in my program where I teach them the skills that they can repeat, they say, this is the first time it's explained this thoroughly and broken down that I now can actually start to use this stuff.
Yes. And so I will mention once again, this is our fund drive here at our radio station. We really appreciate your funds during this time. And we are asking for a $50 donation. And your wonderful bonus gift when you can donate $50 to the radio station here is to reboot your relationship 5-part video series with Dr. Cheryl Fraser. And there are worksheets involved. And this is wonderful because it's like a mini course for couples. It's a chance to reboot your relationship. I'm sure most women go through it first and then they involve their partner if they're in that. Or one person will go through it first and then they'll say, okay, let's do this together. And it's 5 different short videos and 5 powerful workshops to help you have the conversations that you've been avoiding maybe about
Right. And to set some action steps to move towards some change. And, you know, one of the great compliments that I'm very pleased to have had is from men. A lot of men relate to my style and pretty straightforward and pretty down to earth. When I had a full-time private practice, I now exclusively do the online 3-month program. I do it once or twice a year. for couples. But when I had a full-time private practice, I saw a lot of police officers, a lot of mill workers, blue-collar fellows. I saw soldiers on deployment, male and female. And it's really, men are underappreciated in terms of their emotional depth. And I get a little fed up when I hear, you know, oh, well, men aren't emotional, or, oh, well, men aren't interested in working on their relationship. Men are deep and beautiful and just as idiosyncratic as women. And some of them are deep and some of them maybe are afraid to go there. But you might be surprised at how many men initiate during the work I do as well. It's always a delight to me because we assume, and it's not an irrational assumption, but we assume that generally females in a heterosexual relationship anyway, I work with all comers, anyone, LGBTQ plus, rainbow, you're all my people, whoever and however you love.
Great.
Welcome to improve that love and that beauty between the two of you. But primarily heterosexual couples come to my work, and I'd say it's about 30 or 35%, it is the man initiating, I want more, we want more, we can be better than
sure, that. Of course.
Beautiful.
Yes, and it should, yes, I think that makes sense. I mean, they also have a lot more hormones than women in a later age. And so it's it makes a lot of sense. The phone number again to call is 818-985-KPFK. That's 818-985-5735. And there's kpfk.org is also good. It's great to go there and make sure that you look for the Dr. Cheryl's mini course for couples. It's called Reboot Your Relationship. And again, it's how to have those, lean into those hard conversations, but in a fun way that you've been avoiding. I mean, there's, you want to avoid conflict and romance and sex and all of that. Lean into it. Make it part of, make it fun. Make it an action step. Make it something that you can lean into. I'm all about that. Just, it's a hard conversation. There's going to be a lot more energy taken from you if you don't have the conversation than if you do.
Right. And you know, Lisa, I'm fond of saying something so simple, but it generally lands home. There's only ever three choices in our romantic relationship. We stay the way it is. We leave, break up, have an affair, try with someone else. Or we stay in and we change it. And because we're neither foolish nor masochistic, if we stay and change it, we want to change it for the better. And if you want to change the layout of your living room, it takes looking at the way it is now, looking how you might want to improve it and learning how to do that. And that's what people will learn a good amount of that in the program, in the free program. And it's a great distillation of what I teach in the large program. And it's really valuable as a standalone. That's the way I wanted it to be, is valuable as a standalone to get us talking. So we've talked about intimacy, where I really mean communication, apology, connection, kindness, appreciations, hopes and dreams, and more. We've talked a bit about thrill, which is frankly, like I said, get off your bum and try harder. Romance your spouse again. Have more fun. Don't take out the bloody phones at dinner. Put them away. If you've got an urgent possible babysitter situation, leave it only on for that and ideally mute everything else. And be present. And if you find you have nothing to talk about, there's lots of ways to reboot that simply. Go Google interesting questions to ask my spouse on a date and you'll get some bunch of ideas, because not everybody's creative and we might be a little nervous to broach certain topics. They've been touch points in the past that, you know, and then we might just talk about the frickin' weather or the mortgage. That's not a date. That's right, planning right. session. And it's important. You should talk about the date or the mortgage and maybe the weather, I guess, especially if it's going to affect your choices around which kind of car you're going to buy, but not on a date. I want dates to be about the future, maybe reminiscing of the past, maybe talking about trips you've gone on that were amazing. And you don't have to be creative. Rely on wonderful other creative people to give you ideas. There's card games for couples. They're a delight. Right? Any store, any online purchase, you can find, you know, interesting conversation starters for your spouse. And just take the pressure off you. And people are often really surprised how much fun they have having those conversations. Try them on a long road trip. It's great.
It's also fun when you go out on couples dates, because it makes your, you know, after conversation fun and about something different than you usually have your after conversation with.
Yeah.
Question for you about, hormones. You know, I wanted to ask you about that, because hormones do decline after a certain age. What do you do to keep the, you know, the attraction going? Does it always fade because the hormones fade? Is that a myth?
Boy, oh boy, this is the third side of the passion triangle. So we've got the intimacy, we've got the thrill, and then we've got what I call sensuality. Sensuality. And I use that word very deliberately because I'm talking about non-sexual touch, cuddling, connection, and warmth, as well as the erotic and the sexual side of things. And do we have 15 hours? No, we don't. So a short but important set of things I'd love to share with you and the listeners right now, because this is such a fraught topic for the majority of couples over time. By the way, 3 or 4 or 5 years together counts as a long-term relationship, in that a lot of this changes. Couples in their 30s, 40s, and 50s talk about a real decrease in sensual or sexual desire for one or both partners. But it's not just the so-called hormones. Physiology is an aspect of it. We're all pretty familiar with female menopause and maybe somewhat familiar with male andropause, where their testosterone and other hormones can change. It's a very real thing, but it's one factor.
I think menopause has a lot more side effects than andropause.
I think we have to be careful about generalizations. Although that is an accurate generalization, we need to talk about the specific human, right? It can wallop some men and wallop some women. Yeah. Other women have a higher desire after menopause. It's a subset, but it's a significant subset. But let me put it this way. I talk about a multifactorial causality of our sensual turn on or desire or interest or attraction. We've got the physical, not just hormone changes, which are certainly relevant well before our 50s as well, through childbirth, through our 40s, men and women bodies, they change. Then we've got things like actual changes in the functioning of our sexuality itself. We've got fatigue. We've got busyness. We've got lifestyle. Not everybody eats and exercises in a way which helps them feel more vital. The word libido comes from the Latin, and it means life force. When you're feeling logy and tired and dragged down, your sleep, oh my goodness, could we talk about sleep? Poor sleep. And none of this lends itself to easy turn on because you're freaking tired. And the couch and the remote control seem like a much nicer seduction than actually having to do something reasonably or somewhat active in terms of moving towards perhaps an erotic or a lovemaking encounter. Then there's the mental part. Complacency and moving into this marriage incorporated or relationship incorporated, where we are more like roommates and parents and buddies than we are a romantic couple. If we're not cultivating thrill, if we're not cultivating fun and connection, if we're not willing to be a bit spicy together, to have some flirtation with each other, to, you know, get a naughty card deck and ask each other some fun or naughty or spicy questions. No kidding, it feels very weird, Lisa, to go from I had a cold and I was in my bunny PJs and you brought me chicken soup and I was blowing my nose all day and we snuggled up and watched a silly show to feeling like an erotic animal together. It's a big leap. So we almost accidentally, by attrition, neuter ourselves as sensual beings. And that attraction requires a bit of space and a bit of dynamic movement. Going dancing can be a great idea to play with those energies. The couple that we were talking about that did the dance sort of encounter and growth experience we did together at that event, they teach men and women how to lead and play partly to create a sense of energetic attraction and play between each other. Okay, I'm going to lay a statistic on people that will be discouraging to some and a big bloody relief to many, which is around 30 to 40% of couples in a longer term relationship, 5 or more years, doesn't matter what age, are rarely or never making love. Rarely or never making love. They're in what is defined as a clinically sexless relationship where they make love 6 or fewer times a year. Of those, many have not made love in many, many years, but no one's talking about it. So when I share this right now, there's been a collective exhale in a third of the listening audience who think they're the only ones. All their friends, they assume, have an okay or maybe even a good sensual life. They feel uniquely broken. They may have argued and fought about desire differences for so long, it's just not talked about anymore. Someone feels pressured, guilty, and like they're letting their partner down. The other feels undesired, unimportant, and unfulfilled. There's so much pain wrapped up in what can be this gentle, beautiful, or raw and spicy, or anything in between, aspect of being alive.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're choosing monogamy and we're neglecting the eroticism between you and I, we're choosing a sexless existence, except perhaps for some solo pleasure. And that arguably is a very great loss. Because even if it's a small percentage of our life in terms of hours per month, maybe it's, you know, 1 hour a month, it can bring a type, I will argue, of emotional and even spiritual closeness, a type of playfulness and joy, a type of connection and release, and sometimes a type of, that was really spicy and crazy, and I feel a bit like chagrined, and it was delightful. But it's an aspect of being alive that I would put forward we really neglect, not at our peril maybe, but we neglect something that is part of a well-lived life, a small but significant and powerful part of love and life and connection and freedom and play.
So you're saying, so if you look up the statistic on sexless relationships, which is considered a sexless relationship, you said is sex.
One of the definitions, six or fewer times a year, so every couple of months. By the way, you won't find this if you search it because there's terrible research about it.
Nobody
you're
going to
find things like 11% or 15%.
Right.
It's because there's surveys, people don't want to answer them honestly, or maybe people that are sexless don't want to participate. So we're not getting good research. Doctoral and master students listening, take this topic on, research the heck out of it, please. But I've interviewed probably 10,000 people in terms of when I do a free masterclass a couple times a year, and people come from all over, and I do polls.
Okay.
And over and
say,
over
survey
and
said
30 to 42% not
wow.
make it at all in a sexless relationship. And every time I have the honor to be on a stage, to be on a microphone as I am with you today, or to talk to a half a dozen interested people out in the world, I will share this information with them. If I have 5 minutes, I'll probably slip in how common low sex or sexless relationships are, because I know there are people, even in a group of six people, that are in that situation, aren't talking about it, don't know who to talk to, and feel uniquely broken. And then they might feel the dangerous, maybe I'm with the wrong person.
What about 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? Do you have those cases as well?
I can't parse out how many of each of those. I can say in the couples who take my program, 30 to 42% sexless or very, very low sex. And of those, many of them, it's been multiple years, even 5, 6, 7, 8 or 10 years.
I was thinking when I was researching this, I was thinking about, do you remember I Love Lucy? And Tennessee and Lucy, or whatever his name was.
Yeah.
Ricky
in the show, right?
Ricky Ricardo. And they had separate beds, or did they have separate bedrooms, right?
I
can't remember.
It's a little on the old side for me. I did watch it as a young kid, but I feel like they had at least twin beds.
Twin beds.
For sure,
right?
Twin beds. Maybe in the same room.
And it was like that was America's version of having a relationship on TV at the time. So
right.
There was a lot of shame. That's where I'm going with this.
And puritanical nature. And, you know, it was pretty romantic and scandalous if you kissed on the lips, but it wasn't going to be an erotic kiss.
Right.
You know, it was neutered. It was boiled down. And I mean, come on, you're married to a passionate Latino. There's got to be some great sex happening.
Right. But yep. And it's funny. So it's the way it was depicted as, you know, on television. And I don't think, you know, there was now it's like, look, you had the Enola, or that movie that won Best Actress, I think it was, for the sex workers and so forth. I mean, it's a totally different environment. Anyway, this is such an interesting topic, because I love that you said something that has not been said. Your clinical experience is definitely more credible than what you would read in social media. And I love that you're not shaming anyone for it, that there's ways out of it, that you can restart the conversation, that you can get some help. There's plenty of things out there that can help you. What are you suggesting?
I suggest some things that aren't particularly popular when they're not explained more deeply. They're not negative, but one of the most important things when a couple is ready, they might need to do a fair bit of work to get to where they're ready to begin to move towards a sensual encounter again, an erotic encounter with or without intercourse, with or without full completion. But they may not even be comfortable being nude together. So I would start with potentially snuggling more and working up to feeling a little more comfortable and doing a lot of work on what gets in the way, what turns me on and off, what am I afraid of. What we're doing, and this doesn't sound very sexy, Lisa, but tough darts. It's effective and it's what all the experts will say. Esther Perel, the incomparable, brilliant Esther Perel, a colleague of mine, she says married sex is scheduled sex. And there's a brilliant research group out of the UBC Sexual Health Clinic, and one of them, Rosemary Besson, who created the newer model of female sexual responsivity and female sexual desire. She says the majority of long-term couples are making love from a place of sexual neutrality. What does that mean? It means we start making love when neither of us is turned on, which sounds odd. But scheduling a sensual encounter, making it a priority, making it a hobby. You don't always feel like going out for a golf game if the weather isn't good. You probably don't always feel like getting on the bicycle. There's probably the odd day where you're like, oh, you're kind of tired. It's kind of logy. You might rather just have a waffle and drink some tea. But you do it because it's important to you. And you do it because you know at the end of it, you'll feel a sense of accomplishment. You'll be glad you did it. You'll be pleased you made the effort. I know this doesn't sound romantic or sexy, but people, you know it's not romantic or sexy, never making love at all and fighting about it all the time. And at least one of you really feeling that that's important and one of you feeling you're not sure it is. Those are both very valid points of view. So I have people work to their level at their capacity toward where they would schedule a sensual encounter because married sex is scheduled sex, so to speak. The majority of long-term couples start making love from a place of sexual neutrality. You need to start the process of moving towards being in a state of desire or turn on just because you decide it's important to you, which is not as fun as it used to be. When you started making love because you felt like it and it was easy and you were intrigued and you were driven to say, oh, baby, we've got an hour.
Right. I mean, this is how we should have started the show. I'm so grateful that you mentioned all of this and you gave people permission to know that they're not the only ones if they're in a sexless marriage. It's different than a loveless marriage. You could still love somebody, but And okay, well, I think there's so much more to do and definitely people will find you and your website because this is a big topic.
Yeah. And I have a podcast where I talk about these topics in a lot more detail. People might really enjoy that if they've heard anything.
It's a great name. What's the name of your podcast?
Sex, Love, and Elephants.
Yep. Why elephants? Because it's the elephant in the room.
That's a brilliant interpretation, but not actually why, but ding, ding, ding for creativity. To me, the elephant is a symbol of Buddhist awakening. So the podcast is mainly about romantic sexual relationships, but it's also about awareness, about growth, about managing your own mind state, about taking responsibility for your happiness, because no one, not even your so-called soulmate, which doesn't exist, no one can make you happy. Happiness is an inside job. So that's part of what weaves through my work and why elephant crept in there.
Oh, beautiful. Well, once again, you can give us a call. It is our fund drive for a $50 donation. There's a wonderful bonus that you will receive from Dr. Cheryl Fraser. It's her Reboot Your Relationship 5-part powerful workshop series. Would love you to donate to the station, and we really appreciate those donations. And in the meantime, it's called Reboot Your Relationship. Give us a call, 818-985-5735. And I want to mention support for the Aware Show comes in part from Dr. Cheryl Fraser and her Reboot Your Relationship online course. Further information is available at drcherylfraser.com, and that's drcherylfraser.com. Thank you so much, Cheryl. So much appreciation for you and for all that you do for all relationships in the world. Thank you. They're very important.
Thank you. It's an absolute joy. And peace and harmony, love and acceptance, forgiveness and understanding begin at home. And when we're not playing that out well with our chosen person, how can we expect to change the world? So awareness starts at home as well.
Beautiful. Thank you, Cheryl. All right. Thank you. And thank you all for listening. Thank you, Gina Salvati, for our wonderful producing here on The Aware Show. I'm Lisa Garr. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.
The program that you just heard was a rebroadcast. It previously aired here on KPFK.
Let me tell you a story. On June 23rd, 1967, the LAPD beat anti-war demonstrators bloody. Only one radio station in the Southland covered the beatings, KPFK. And that was the day a young kid in Pacoima broke open his piggy bank and joined KPFK. This is Greg Pallas. I was that kid. And for 55 years, I've been a member of KPFK and Pacifica stations. Why? Because the courageous reporting continues. And when other media covers up the news, KPFK uncovers it. Won't you join me? This is Greg Pallas asking you to go to kpfk.org. And if you got one of those telephone things, 818-985-5735.